Welcome. My name is Leroy Eisminger. I'm a retired Lutheran pastor from South Dakota. I met one of our class members a few years ago, and I was really surprised when he came up to see me the other night and say, "Do you remember me?" And I'm one of these guys that always forgets a name but never remembers a face. I was hoping we'd have enough people because I'm going to need some readers for tomorrow. And if some of you men wouldn't mind being women tomorrow, well, they could be men too. We're going to be talking tomorrow about the unseen inmate, and that's the family. And I've got some old testimonials of what it was like to all of a sudden realize that your husband was going to go to prison, or your brother. So if some of you would be willing to take one of these tomorrow and read it, I'd appreciate your doing that.
Sure.
This is one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And these are all women's roles? No.
Yeah, they're all women, but we can pretend that they're some of them are men.
Okay.
How many do you have?
I have six.
Is it just one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. They're all women.
And this goes
together.
Yeah. Okay. I'll take that one.
Yeah. Okay. The title of today is The Forgotten Fifth, and I'll read from Matthew 25, beginning with verse 34. The king will say to those at his right hand, "Come, blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, you gave me food. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was cold and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or cold and clothe thee? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me." Now, most of our churches have programs to feed the hungry. Can you share what your church might do to feed the hungry?
We participate in an ecumenical kitchen,
mm-hmm.
and our turn comes up periodically to help there.
Yeah.
Food has a very strong fish program. That,
what does the fish do?
Friends and service to humanity, but through the church, it's every month they have by the end of the second week of the month, where they collect everything that's been given, it goes into the community food basket thing that's operated by fish. Other than that's the only really ongoing thing. Occasionally, Christmas. We always have Christmas baskets and that sort of thing, but
in Sioux Falls, where we're from, we have a program called The Banquet, which feeds the hungry, and it's remarkable. If your church wants to serve The Banquet, they already have now over a 2-year waiting list of people waiting. Congregations waiting to serve.
The thing is, it's not just churches, though. It's
no,
all types of organizations,
yeah,
that also do this besides churches.
And so, What have you done for the stranger?
Is this a daily thing, Leroy?
Just about now.
Oh, Sunday evening is the only evening that they do.
Oh. Do not, yeah. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's every evening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Monday morning breakfast.
And they have about at least 400 guests who come to that ministry. What is your congregations, or what do congregations do for the stranger or for the refugee?
My congregation has a program that does a little of both of what you're talking about. 9 months out of the year, excluding the summer, we bring in every Sunday afternoon, late afternoon, men from a homeless shelter that's run by the Catholic Church of Seattle. They have this farmed out to all kinds of churches, so we're just a small part of it. But we bring these men usually anywhere from 7 to 10, I think, at a time. Bring them out, turn our multi-purpose room into a sleeping area. Give them a good meal that evening and then breakfast the next morning and take them back. And it's particularly helpful, we're told, in the wintertime, of course, when the weather, even in Seattle, can be pretty nasty. So.
Well, many congregations are involved in refugee resettlement. I'm not a pastor of a country church near Sioux Falls. I think there were 4 refugee families that we helped resettle. People from Vietnam, from Laos, from Cambodia. Now our church is involved in resettling people from where?
Sudanese, a lot of Sudanese. We've had some Bosnians, but the Sudanese pretty much now.
And for those who are naked or cold, churches help in homeless shelters, involved in clothing drives. Many churches have quilting bees where they make quilts. Mm-hmm. I don't know if your churches know that. But the fifth line, the forgotten fifth, those in prison, what do we do for those? Many congregations are very actively involved in taking care of the first 4, the hungry, the refugee, those who are cold, and those who are sick. Now, when somebody in your congregation is sick, there's mention of it probably in the church bulletin. You pray for that person? Oh, hi.
Hi.
We're supposed to announce that the safety holds training is postponed.
Oh, till when?
Tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Tomorrow at 3 o'clock.
Okay. People are urged to pray for those who are sick. There are, in some churches, visitation teams. Mm-hmm. Who go to the hospital to visit that person. But for every man that you go and visit in the hospital, there are 5 men somewhere in this country locked up. Our country has a reputation of locking up more people, giving longer sentences, and executing more people than any other country in the world except Saudi Arabia. And we have all of these people locked up, and what does the church do for them? Many congregations I discovered when I was pastor of a prison congregation didn't even realize that there was a prayer in our hymn book for people who are in prison. And I'd like to have us pray that prayer. Lord Jesus, for our sake you were condemned as a criminal. Visit our jails and prisons with your pity and judgment. Remember all prisoners and bring the guilty to repentance and amendment of life according to your will, and give them hope for their future. When any are held unjustly, bring them release. Forgive us and teach us to improve our justice. Remember those who work in these institutions, keep them humane and compassionate. Save them from becoming brutal or callous. And since what we do for those in prison, O Lord, we do for you, lead us to improve their lot. All this we ask for your mercy's sake. Amen. And again, I was very hesitant about doing this. I had only gone to visit members of my congregation in prison who had been there for DWIs, never anyone for any kind of criminal activity. But finally I said, yes, I'll come and be interviewed, and the rest was history. On February 1st, 1990, I began what I considered my best parish. I have been a Lutheran pastor for over 40 years, most of it in South Dakota, but the last 10 plus years of my life were my best parish. And I often told people that the Lord again saved the best until last, because it was my best ministry. While it was my best ministry, my 90-year-old mother would get tired of people saying, we never thought Leroy would end up in prison. She got kind of tired of that. And so I began my work within the maximum security prison of South Dakota. My job description was to start a Lutheran congregation. And so I went around from cell to cell, inviting men to come to our congregation, that we would have a worship service sometime in the future. There were a lot of hoops to jump through, and we didn't have our first worship service until Ascension Day in May. I started in February. Those who are starting home mission congregations in, a new suburb, often share their frustration by saying, I never find anybody at home. That was never my problem. And so we met on the on Ascension Day. Come on in. Welcome.
Hi there.
This is
prison ministry, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
Do you know where fire training is?
No, it's canceled.
It's canceled.
Oh, look at this. Postponed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So,
you can stay.
It's canceled until tomorrow, I believe, at 3 o'clock.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Thank you.
Okay. And I began my work in February. We had our first worship service on Ascension Day. And then we had our Synod Assembly in the first part of June, where we were formally accepted as a congregation of the South Dakota Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. We had to pick a name, and the name that the men picked was Dismas, Saint Dismas. Now, the Roman Catholics spell it differently, but this was the name. And he's been made a saint. The name comes from tradition. When Jesus was crucified, there were two men crucified with him. And it is believed that one of them was Dismas, and the other one was a man by the name of Justus. Now, there's no biblical proof of that, of course. It's tradition that has come down. But it is believed that these two men were the ones hanging on the cross. According to tradition, Dismas and Justus had met Jesus before. When Joseph received the vision to take Mary and the young baby and flee, on their way to Egypt, they encountered two robbers. It was believed that they were Dismas and Justus. And Dismas realized that this was a special couple. He did not want his partner to harm them. They had nothing to steal. And just as told Dismas, I will not harm them if you give me 20 pieces of your silver. And that was done, and as they went away, it is reported that Mary said to Gestas, or to Dismas, God shall forgive you all your sin, my son. Well, they meet again on the cross, and Dismas asked Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come in your kingdom. And that's why the men selected the name Dismas, is because of his prayer. I asked them, well, what is your rationale? Why do you want to be called St. Dismas? He said, because of his prayer. He didn't want to die forgotten, and neither do we. And so they said, it's hope that by calling our congregation Dismas, that every time you go out and talk to congregations about St. Dismas, that these congregations will remember that there are people in prison. They do not want to die forgotten. And I started this congregation, St. Dismas, in the prison, and it resembled a normal congregation. One of the things that makes it better than a chaplaincy is that in a prison, we do not teach inmates how to be responsible. We teach them how to be dependent. They are told what to do and when to do it. And they have to ask permission for everything. But in our congregation, we had men assuming positions of leadership. Our first president of the congregation was serving life without parole for his involvement in two murders. But there had been a significant life change in this man, and he became our first president of our congregation. I was allowed to have worship on Thursday nights. This would not conflict with the chaplain, who had worship on Sunday, and the Roman Catholic priest who had worship on Sunday. I came at a time when the government of South Dakota terminated all state-paid chaplains. And so this was really kind of a gift to the prison to have someone come in that they did not have to pay, but who would be taking care of some of the religious responsibilities. The congregation resembled a normal congregation, although I didn't have any ladies' aid meetings. I didn't have any weddings. We did have a choir, a fantastic choir. They even made a professional tape that was used. Our choir also appeared on a Sunday evening radio station, and it was a marvelous choir. I didn't have any late night council meetings or no building committee meetings. We had several memorial services, men who died in prison. I had one funeral service of a man who committed suicide in prison, but because their church did not have a pastor, I had the service. Incidentally, South Dakota has the highest suicide rate of any prison in our country. I'm not sure exactly why that is. One of the features of a prison congregation was that I was allowed to bring in 12 people from the outside. And I would ask a congregation a few miles away, would you come on a Thursday night and be with our men? There was some hesitancy at first. But now there is about a year and a half waiting list for people eager to come back because the experience that they felt and found within that prison congregation changed them, changed their attitudes towards inmates. Invariably, I'd have somebody out in the parking lot after the worship service was over say to me, that young man tonight who helped you with communion reminded me of my grandson. And I would say, well, he is somebody's grandson. That man who read the Old Testament lesson, he looked like a man down the street from us. And I said, well, he is a man from down the street. It humanized these inmates. Because for so many people, they look at inmates as someone different than they. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about a program called WAIT. It's a ministry to the unseen inmate. And one of the things that the people of that support group would say time and time again, having someone in prison is something that could happen to absolutely anyone. Professionally speaking, we had people across the board. I mean, I had a chief of the fire company, had a policeman, had a doctor, a dentist, a social worker who got involved with one of his clients.
Clergymen, lawyers?
Yeah, I had three pastors. That wasn't a surprise to some people, I suppose.
There were lawyers. One had been on faculty at the law school.
Yeah, one was the dean of the South Dakota Law School at the University of South Dakota. Got him in prison there. Well, speaking of that, my parish, I had a parish at Crooks, South Dakota. And when I announced to my congregation in Pierre that I had accepted a call to Crooks, South Dakota, the president of the congregation got up and said, I've never heard of Crooks, but it sounds like an appropriate place for you. But and not only that, but it was a time when these men had a chance to relate to people on a one-on-one basis. For example, at the counselor's office down on the main floor of the cell hall, this is a counselor, quotes, but on the front of the door it says, if I have not called you and you are standing here, you are loitering. I mean, a guy who needed counseling could not come until the counselor called him. Couldn't just see this person as a helper. And a lady came to me after the service one night and said, a man came up to me and my husband and thanked us for coming and thanked us for calling him by name, because he said most of the people here in prison give me a nickname because of his crime. And then he said to them, you're real people. And she said, what did he mean by real people? Aren't the guards and the other people in prison real people? And I said, well, I don't know about that. I think what he meant was that you were willing to talk to him one-on-one as one human being to another. And so this is kind of the genius of a prison congregation over against that of a chaplaincy, because what we have here in South Dakota, we have now three congregations in South Dakota, one in Sioux Falls, one at Springfield, and at the women's prison in Pierre. What you have here is the congregation, St. Dismas, but you have all these ties to these congregations out here who have never had an opportunity to visit someone in prison. I was in prison and you visited me. And these people who would come to our Thursday night service could go back and say, I visited my Lord in prison. And that was the St. Dismas. One of the things we couldn't do there was to take up an offering. It was not allowed. And so we became very dependent upon these congregations out here for financial support of St. Dismas. 80% of my congregation was unemployed. Not that the men didn't want to work, but there simply weren't enough opportunities for them to work in that very overcrowded prison. And those who did work, their take-home pay was $1.20 for 8 hours of hard work. And out of that $1.20 would have to come their commissary needs, their toothpaste, their soap, their shampoo, their writing tablet, their pen, whatever, shaving lotion. And I can tell you that those men would have to pay many more times for that product at the commissary in prison than you can buy for them in your local grocery store or pharmacy. It's simply another example, I believe, of how the powerful and the rich take advantage of the poor and those who have no voice. And yet, out of my congregation, I had several tithers. And in the 6 previous congregations that I served, I never had any. For me, it was really a wonderful experience to be their pastor. And was a way for these outside congregations to minister to what is normally called the Forgotten Fifth. Now, out of this congregation that I started, St. Dismas, there grew another organization called Prison Congregations of America. And that's Prison Congregations of America. And back there, you have 4 handouts of this. It's a national organization began by a pastor at Vermilion, South Dakota. And what has come out of that is that there have been new congregations organized in, there are 9 of them. This one here is kind of questionable, whether it's going to succeed or not. It's just hanging on by its teeth because the pastor who organized the congregation shortly after its organization accepted a call someplace else. But these are the states in which there are prison congregations. And he has back there 4 things that I'd like to have you pick up, because even if your congregation is involved in a jail ministry, if there's some way in which you can bring others to visit those who are in prison. I was in prison and you visited me. I'd like to have you be sure to pick up this sheet here, who is welcome here. I got this from this particular copy from our South Dakota University Lutheran Center. But I had it before, and we wanted to tell the men in the prison who is welcome. And I read it. It says here, if you suffer from addiction to drugs and alcohol, you are welcome here. Over 90% of the men in our prison are there because of some alcohol or drug-related crime. 70% of them, 77%, are addicted. If you are a single parent, you are welcome here. If you are gay or lesbian, you are welcome here. If you are self-righteous, you are welcome here. If you have fathered children without taking responsibility for them, you are welcome here. If your skin color or your heritage are different from most, you are welcome here. If you are judgmental, you are welcome here. If you are selfish, you are welcome here. If you are a sinner like us, you are welcome here. That became kind of an explosive thing. And I could not and I did not ever read it again. Because in the prison, there are various layers of social scrap, you might say. Heading the top of the list up here are those who have been convicted of armed bank robbery. I mean, they're really looked up to. But way down on the list are those who have a different sexual orientation and those who've molested children. And so for a time, it was obvious that there were those in the congregation that were making sure that those kinds of people couldn't come and didn't come, because if they did come, they would probably get beat up while they were going back to their cell. But it was remarkable how attitudes among the inmates began to change. And so finally, everyone was welcome there. One of the things I began to rely on very much was Martin Luther's statement, God is most present when God appears to be most absent. That was borne out for me, especially the night of our first worship service. It was in the auditorium of the prison, cold looking, bare, no symbolism on the walls, very little there to remind you that you were in a worship place of worship. It was exceptionally warm and hot, humid, the windows were open, the wind was from the south. We had no difficulty in determining that the prison was located north of the Sioux Falls Stockyards. And as I got up to preach that night, it just seemed like that verse of Luther came out, God is most present where he seems to be most absent. And that night we had a singer come from Madison, South Dakota, and his special music was Surely the Presence of the Lord is in This Place. I mean, it was just you talk about the hand of God at work, and it just seemed like God did that that night for me, assuring me that this was where I was to be and what God wanted me to do. There's some verses in Scripture that began to take on meaning for me. Isaiah 53, especially. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. As one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised. He was convicted and sentenced and led off to die, and there was no one who cared about his fate. I saw that lived out time and time again within the prison. And it was a gift to me, I think, to have been a pastor there. I want to show you now a video that shows the congregation in action. This is a dated video. It was of the first Lutheran prison congregation here in America, in Jessup, Maryland, started by this pastor who later organized this, what we call Prison Congregations of America.
Thank you. within 2 miles of those big giant prisons. And my church was within, you know, a couple miles of there. And yet, we never, any of us in the church had set foot inside these prisons or knew anyone that had ever been in them. They were for them, and then it was us. Then came a situation in my life where a person that I loved very dearly was convicted of drunk driving and was imprisoned for that. And that was just an astronomical shadow experience to my personal view of the world. Because them was not us.
When they had counsel that came to my office, Cheryl Trunks, and he said, what do you think about the idea of creating within the walls of the congregation? And I said, that was a terrific idea. Because immediately I was thinking about what all could be accomplished through such a creation. Without putting victims who do not think in terms of inmates being taught to take responsibility. That I told them one to go here and one to go there and so forth and so on.
Marianne Burt has been at the forefront of criminal justice issues for 17 years. Politically, her keen insight and experience with the penal system guided officials of the American Lutheran Church through the administrative maze of the Maryland Department of Corrections. Prophetically, her concept of inmate responsibility inspired their mission.
I think that you can never do anything for people. That you have to do it with people. And that this idea of having a congregation within the walls is such an attempt. The inmates are involved. They have a part to play. They have a responsibility to take.
Officials of the Maryland Department of Corrections agreed, and in 1984, formal approval was granted for the formation of a congregation of the American Lutheran Church within the prison system. The community of St. Dismas was about to be born, and from the prairies of South Dakota, Pastor Ed Nesselhoff was called to develop the congregation. Intentionally, he had absolutely no experience with prison ministry.
When I first started, we were a classification officer, so she would go through the files of the 400 women here and bring you a list of the names who had put Lutheran into their denomination. An hour later, she brought me three names. So I looked at Lutheran number one, and I said, I'm here to start a Lutheran congregation. I'm a Lutheran pastor. She said, that sounds great, but I'm going home Monday. I couldn't get to Luther number two because she was unsegregated. And Luther number three thought it was a grand idea, so we started.
That was at MCIW, the Maryland Correctional Institution for Women. Less than a mile away, at MCIJ, the men's prison, a second Lutheran inmate was found. A graduate of Augustana Academy in South Dakota, his relatives included 19th century president of the North Carolina Lutheran Synod. Douglas Erie has spent the past 14 years in prison. During that time, he has earned 5 college degrees and has served as a jailhouse lawyer to inmates and staff alike. It was he who wrote the articles of incorporation for the congregation, and he was chosen to serve as president of the church council at the men's prison. MCIW had already elected its church council and president, and inmates who at the most receive $1.50 a day in wages took on the responsibilities of stewardship by making crafts which were offered for sale at local congregations. St. Dismas, on paper, was rapidly becoming St. Dismas in people. It was a congregation like any other congregation, and a congregation different from any other congregation Ed Nesselhoff had ever encountered.
I'm not sure what I expected to find when I came to start a prison congregation. I've never been around prisons to speak of. I had visited one once in a visiting room. I wasn't here very long, and I could see that the whole name of the game is control and confinement. Isolate people. Something about that, I don't know, just sort of hurt. hurt. I knew around a lot of people here, whether they wanted to be or not, and it's not really like, you know, your baby's here, you don't hear. There's a lot of things like that you don't hear. As you miss.
Giving down there is not a word. Giving is, you just don't do it. It's the more you give, the more they take. They, the people down there have been there for a long time. Some of them have been there 10 times. And they were very, very wise as far as working the system for themselves. And it hurts the people that are not used to that type of situation, that are not that kind of person to use another one. And they end up being the one without anything because these people steal from them, hurt them, tell the officers they're doing things they shouldn't be doing, getting them in trouble. And you look around like, people don't do this. People really don't treat people like this, do they? But they do. And you learn very quickly that people are very cruel.
And it was just a terrible feeling of just coming to like almost like a hell on earth. It was, you know, I didn't want to be around anybody, and you know, just, you know, the doors clanging, and you know, they're telling me what to do everywhere, and take stripping soaps in you, and just really, they really do take, well, literally got left, they take that, you know, and I don't think it's so much a deliberate thing. I think the system is just like that, as it does that. I mean, even if you had the most humane people running it, I mean, the certain security things, yeah, just, you know, they happen, it just really destroys what little bit of dignity or things you might have left.
Problems affecting inmates within our correctional systems are complex and at times overwhelming. The men's facility at MCIJ, for instance, was built to house 500 inmates. Its present population is 973 inmates, an overload of nearly 90%. That inevitably creates tensions and inhibits individual attention.
We do have in the population approximately 9 lifers, people doing life that have progressed through the system, and they're here for all types of crimes, murder, burglaries, assaults, violations of probations, and most of them are repeat offenders. Those people have repeat offenders. I talk about the recidivism rate, where it means how many times a person, once a person goes out, his likelihood of returning, and in the state of Maryland is something where around 65%.
An overcrowded community where 65% of the people have been in prison before. A community where 80% of the inhabitants do not have a high school diploma, and 50% of them have a reading ability of 5th grade or below. A community where 70% of the residents were sexually abused as children. Individuals who were themselves victimized before they became victimizers of society. It is to this pained and fragmented community that St. Dismas sought to bring healing and reconciliation.
That was really one of the beautiful experiences, because I never had anybody really care for me, never had anybody, you know. And I just ridiculed when I made mistakes. Ed wasn't like that. Ed was, you know, he just made you feel comfortable. He made you feel like, you know, it's okay if you can make a mistake or something. Just, you know, try. And that's why I really stuck with saying this was community, because, you know, I mean, coming from the pits, you know, you don't need somebody just to kick you every time you make a mistake, because, you know, we're all going to make mistakes. And I just felt really a lot of brotherhood and a lot of concern for people. And, you know, I just kept coming up, and so now I'm fortunate, and I'm elected to the council there, and without saying this was, you know, I mean, I'm having a lot of troubles anyway, but I got in a lot of trouble in the past, and nobody wants to believe that you changed, and, you know, they think it's all a scam or something, and it's not, you know, and I don't have to prove that to Ed, you know, even though I still try to do that, and I want everybody to believe that, you know, hey, I'm leaving that behind me. I don't get that judgmental stuff, and I really feel comfortable with saying business. So that's why I'm involved.
Terrence told me once that he wasn't badgered or stirred into the kingdom of God, but that he became a Christian because a white couple would come to visit him and hug him in the same little area.
Remember me, Jesus. when we drove up, it was scary, seeing the barbed wire over the fences, and I felt very ill at ease. And I was surprised about how young the prisoners are. Not all of them, but the majority are very young, young women. And of course, they're just like you and me, and I mean, there's, you can't tell by looking at anyone that she's a prisoner. It gives you a sense of togetherness, it gives you a sense of being wanted, and things you don't have on the outside of your room. And so today I know right from wrong, I know where I'm going, I know where I'm headed. I know that God's the answer, and I know that He's helped me. And I was the lost one, He wasn't. He found me, I didn't find Him. Basically, that's where my life is now.
I was 15 years old, and I ran away from home. And I haven't seen my parents in 11 years. And I got into drugs and a lot of other things that I shouldn't have gotten into. And it's a lonely world. And I thought that's all I needed was drugs. Until it got to the point where I didn't have anywhere else to shoot. And I was stealing checks in order to get money because I was tired of selling my body. And I just turned to stealing checks, and that brought me here. And she told me about Community of St. Dismas, the church in which she went to. So I started going there. It was something that I've never felt before in my life. Because when you come from the world in which I lived and all the things that I had to do in my life, then the feeling that I got the night that I was baptized was a feeling that I'll never forget.
In here, I think you'll learn not to expose a lot of real feelings. Because if it's negative feelings, then you know, you're leaving yourself open for a fight. If it's directed at a guard, you're leaving yourself open for disciplinary action. And if it's a positive feeling, it's kind of a weakness, and it's not something that you want to show. So everything gets to be real shallow and surface. And you could kind of let that down on Saturday night for the hour in the Fellowship of St. Dismas. I learned a lot as far as being able to communicate and love people and care about people, you know, within the confines of these gates and these walls that surround this prison, there was still love and freedom and caring for that hour.
Love, freedom, and caring for that 1 hour of worship. That 1 hour of worship quickly became 2 hours on Friday evenings for the men of MCIJ and on Saturday evenings for the women of MCIW. An hour of worship followed by something for which most inmates hungered, simply to sit and talk with visitors from Lutheran congregations on the outside. In 1986, over 1,100 visitors representing 40 area congregations and 15 out-of-state congregations across the nation worshipped at the two St. Dismas services. That linkage with outside congregations not only became absolutely essential to the survival of St. Dismas as a congregation, but to the survival of its members, both in and out of prison.
A lot of these guys have never been paid attention to their entire lives. They know nothing of what love means. And one of the issues is that the Bible talks about love. Without love, you have nothing. And the volunteers, I think, show a degree of love that has never been shown to these people for an interest. And that in itself has been a key to changing people's lives in these penal institutions.
With the importance of the outside visitors from the other congregations, from our support congregations, I can't tell you the value of it. It's the thing that I think keeps most of these guys going back to church, just to have input from the outside world.
There was such a spirit that you could feel. We would sit through the service, we would enjoy ourselves, we were allowed to touch, we were allowed to hug. And the best part was, there was somebody there from the outside. There was a congregation there that was going to share an hour or so with us. Somebody that would come up and say, I'm so glad I got to meet you. Got to meet me? I mean, I have a record. I'm a criminal. Not to them. I'm an individual. I'm a human being. They were giving me self-respect. As I continued into this, my self-respect for myself grew. I grew. I learned to be able to love. I learned to share.
I can't let tears out my mouth and done a lot of horrible things. So while he did, he went to jail. He went to jail when my son was a year old, my son when I was 18. So time went on and I started losing my home. I had to go back to my mother, and I would go back to her. And she made me feel really unwanted. She would throw slings like, get out my house, or I can't deal with this, or I don't want this one here, or, you know, and it was getting to be too much. And well, I hadn't been there anyway, but I felt like this is my mother, and if I ever needed any support, I would always have a home. But it wasn't like that. I had 3 court charges because I was out there stealing, trying to make it with 4 kids in the house, gas and electric telephone, so I went crazy. I got a drug habit, I got kids, and I got a house. And I couldn't do it all by myself. So even so, when I say, I just do my life and let it go either way. Either I live, either it's in a jail or I die. I think I asked for it.
And I think he's saying that God is most present in those worst of situations, because that's the way God is. He goes to where the hurt is the greatest. And he's the one, remember, who will leave the 99 and go after just one who's dumb enough to walk off and get lost and fall in that crack.
Coming from out of town, you know, just to come down here to see us for a minute. You know, and I feel like if they go to that extent to come from California, Louisiana, you know, and we have had them there, you know, and we must have meant something to them, you know. And they said, I keep coming back, you know, and they said, I hope to see you someday in one of the congregations, and it made me feel real good. It made me feel like I've been accepted, you know, not just my immediate family, but my family in the congregation, you know.
It's very important for the inmates to know that people on the outside care about them. So for the people from the church to come in and let them know that they are loved and that they are still people, that they still have identities. I was walking out with very little to go to besides my daughter. I felt with the church that I had a family to go to, and it made such a difference. It made me get this stress a little faster. It made this more important to me and much easier to get to.
The residents in this place are just like the rest of us. We are all looking for hope, all searching for love. We found it here. The music helped, the words helped, but sitting next to people and talking to people was a thing. I would say heart to heart was the most meaningful experience for me in this whole thing. We came on a cold night. Someone in church said to me, what will you talk to those people about? Well, those people are us. We are all the same.
If we do not believe, as correctional professionals, that inmates can be returned to the community to maintain a lawful lifestyle and successfully reintegrate themselves into the community, who else do we expect to believe them? And the community of St. Dismas for us has been a marvelous way to introduce them back into the community, but with a very supportive structure. And quite frankly, for a lot of adult female offenders, without that structure to go to lean on, their likelihood of successful reentry, lawfully into the community in the long run, is diminished. And it doesn't mean that every woman who's joined the community of St. Dismas has left here and been a success. But we have women who have, while they were here and were part of the community, you could see that they truly began to believe that somebody was going to be there for them when they left here.
They do get a chance to put their life back together in a normal way, and they don't have to, you know, wait on somebody to unlock the gate for them, and they don't have to be told to do this and do that, but they can go back to a kind of a normal life and hopefully to a better style of life. So that really keeps me going. We are probably the only congregation in the nation who just loves to lose members.
I miss a lot of the members down there, but not enough to go back to Jessica, you know. I think Jessica was my last step.
And I honestly believe that I'm going to make it, because you say when I leave, I'm not leaving alone.
Jesus, remember me. Jesus,
here, gotten acquainted with them. These people are ready to accept them into the community, help them get a job, whatever. Well, thank you for coming today. Tomorrow we will look at the unseen prison inmate, and I'd like to have you pick up those six handouts again.
I didn't put an extra picture here.
Maybe we should tell them, right, this coming weekend we're missing out on something. There's having, one of the inmates has redone the chapel, or what was our chapel, made chairs, new chairs, made stained glass windows, and that's being dedicated this weekend when we're out here. Beautiful. It's just completely changed the whole worship area there in Sioux Falls because of his
And that would have never happened had it been not been for St. Dismas. St. Dismas gained a very positive picture within the prison system. And it was just, I think, a great thing to have a prison congregation. And I like that idea that these congregations from outside can come and visit those in prison. I encourage you to use that kind of model for your congregation's prison ministry. Okay?
Thank you. Leroy, does that often happen that they, when people are released, that they'll go back into the same community that provided the people who visited them, and then they'll help them along?
It depends. Some of them are assigned to Sioux Falls for a period of time, because when they get out of prison, they may have to take counseling for sex offenders. And that's only available in South Dakota. I mean, in Sioux Falls, I mean. But some of them will go back to a community because somebody in that community has promised them a job. One of the men that I know, he's been in touch with me a couple times from Milbank. The congregation up there came down and he got acquainted with a dairy farmer. And this dairy farmer said, "Now, when you get out, I've got a job for you." Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Back there.